The Good, the Bad, and the Equine in Rio, today on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp, all eyes on Brazil as the Olympics continue. But behind the scenes, the country's politics are still in shambles. And no amount of Olympic hoopla can change that for Rio residents, also known as cariocas.
People are still very much aware of the political machinations going on in the background. People are still incensed.
But you have the positive side as well, which is how welcoming cariocas are.
More on that carioca spirit coming up. Also, you'll be surprised where some of those Olympic horse riding skills came from originally.
And the dancing in place thing, where the front hooves are kind of pawing the ground, that's actually designed to stomp a fallen enemy.
A short history of dressage, plus why the diving pool in Rio turned green. That's all ahead on The World. It's only day 5 at the Rio Olympics, but already we've seen a lot of magical moments, like 31-year-old Michael Phelps swimming his way to his 20th and 21st Olympic gold medals last night, and fans in the Aquatic Center going crazy celebrating. It is really fun to watch. But I want to start our Olympic coverage today with something a bit more serious that's going on in the stands in Rio, specifically among some Brazilian fans. Several have been ejected for displaying political protest signs inside Olympic venues. The World's Man in Rio, Will Carlos, says the ejections have only served to give the protesters more attention.
Well, that's the irony of this whole thing, is that, you know, to begin with, there are a few signs out there, you know, people holding up Fora Temer, which means get rid of Temer, who is the acting interim president, who's not particularly popular in Brazil. And, you know, probably a few thousand people noticed that. People probably saw it on their screens. Wasn't a big deal. And then they started to kick these people out. And so at that point, you've got these scenes of police officers, you know, pulling people out of stadiums. At that point, it goes viral, and suddenly everybody's paying attention to it.
It's a different game now when you start playing around with images like that.
It really is. And then you've got this this judge who late last night issued a ruling saying, look, I mean, free speech doesn't stop at the door of the Olympic Games. Fancy that. Now, ironically, really ironically, and this might be a little inside baseball, but ironically, the law that they were relying on to kick people out of these stadiums was actually signed. It's a special Olympic law that was signed by President Dilma Rousseff. So she is Temer's sort of arch rival, and the law that she signed was sort of originally protecting, sort of getting rid of protesters who were protesting against him. So if you can wrap your head around that, it's sort of irony upon irony.
It's really good. I like it. Okay, so step back a bit. What is going on in Brazilian politics now?
So it's the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff is kind of chugging along. It's a long, arduous process. And last night, Brazil's Senate voted in a long marathon session, about 2 o'clock this morning, actually, voted to indict her, which means she will now go on trial. The real thing you need to know about that is that it basically pushes this into the final phase. And the final phase of this is that she goes on trial, and around about August 20th, sometime around the end of the month, there is going to be a final drop-dead vote on whether she gets impeached or not. And so she's almost certainly sort of political dust at this point.
I got to say, from here, it sounds like she's already been impeached several times over.
It does from here too, believe me. I mean, it's this long. I mean, look, we're dealing with the impeachment, the removal of power of a sitting democratically elected president. So, you know, the process should be arduous. It should be long. I think a lot of people would argue it should be complicated. So it is complicated. If you drill into it, every one of these stages makes sense. From afar, it can look a bit kind of convoluted and confusing.
Yeah, no, you make a good point. It's not just deja vu. It is actually an important process. So all this is happening, all the political drama is happening, or at least bubbling away still, while the Olympics take center stage. But do people in Brazil really care about politics right now? It seems like they might care more about Rafaela Silva, the child of Rio's toughest neighborhood, winning a gold in judo.
Right, indeed. Well, I mean, that's certainly taking everyone's attention right now. I mean, I would say there's been a kind of a strange shift in Rio. In the weeks leading up to the Olympic Games, there was a lot of ambivalence, a lot of frustration, a lot of people kind of voicing skepticism at the Games and sort of calling it a waste of money and stuff like that. There has been been a certain resurgence of sort of national pride and that sort of stuff, I would say that people are still incensed. I mean, that the whole Fora Temer signs controversy shows that people are still kind of aware of the political machinations going on in the background. If indeed this is a coup, as many people argue that it is, it's kind of a genius move to stretch it out this long so that the most crucial element of it is going on while everybody's attention is distracted by green water in the diving pool and the, you know, the refugee Olympians and everything else and all these other wonderful stories.
That was the world's Will Carlos in Rio. Will mentioned the green water in the Olympic diving pool. Looks like that sheen of green has now spread to the water polo pool right next to it. A lot of people are wondering why this has happened. Let's find out more from Anton Troyanovsky. He's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal in Rio. Anton, how did people react when they first realized that the diving pool had turned green?
Well, spectators and certainly television viewers around the world were rather confused by what was going on, but so were the divers themselves. The team leader of the Canadian team yesterday, for example, told me he had never seen something like that, to have a pool go from blue to green within hours. And it was the synchronized diving 10-meter competition for the women that was happening yesterday as the pool turned green. And what some of the divers said was that actually the green color helped them because it was a different color from the sky. So it helped them get oriented as they were coming down. But certainly it was a very, very strange situation here.
And you saw it yourself?
I did, yes. It was this deep, bright green color that I had never really seen on a pool before, kind of accentuated by all the stadium lights. And what made it particularly jarring is that this Aquatic Center Stadium actually has two pools right next to each other. There's the diving pool, and then there's also a larger water polo pool right next to it. And that water polo pool looked completely normal yesterday, perfect clear blue.
Wow. So tell me more about the athletes and their reactions. Some of them must have been apprehensive about diving into something that was not the color they expected.
Yes. The Canadian athletes said they weren't too worried about the health impact, but they did decide not to open their mouth underwater.
Sounds wise, but difficult.
Right. Well, I mean, everyone is saying at this point that the color change poses no health hazard. Today, what officials are saying is that this was caused by a sudden change in the alkalinity of the pool, causing it to turn green. In fact, the FINA, the World Governing Body for Swimming, just put out a statement saying their finding was that this was caused by the water tanks at the pool running out of some of the chemicals used in the water treatment process.
Are there any serious implications? I mean, is there a sense that the water was not clean enough as a result?
What this is really is kind of another minor embarrassment for this Olympics that's had a few hiccups along the way, and as well as some security scares. In terms of the competition itself, it was not affected. And FINA, the swimming governing body, today also reiterated that they don't see any risk to the health and safety of the athletes and no reason for the competition to be affected. So the competition itself is continuing as planned, and this is more of a kind of a strange incident and minor embarrassment than anything else.
Going back to before when you were talking about divers saying for some of them it really seemed like the extra contrast helped, but are there any implications there in terms of judging or competing or different standard?
That's a great question. I think divers that perform outdoors are used to performing in a lot of different situations, you know, maybe not in terms of the water color changing, but you've certainly got issues, you know, of the kind of reflection and glare of the water changing depending on where the sun is or the time of day or the brightness of the stadium lights. So I don't think there was a specific implication there in terms of judging of this green water.
It sounds like everybody just went ahead. I was really struck by that, actually, just reading about it. It's like, well, this is what color it is, but we're at the Olympics and we have competition, so here we go.
Yeah, that's been the theme throughout, you know, same with the open water competitions like sailing, where, you know, there have been real concerns about the cleanliness of the water. Athletes are saying, well, this is another risk we have to deal with, but, you know, this is our career, our big moment in the spotlight, and athletes here are, for the most part, aren't letting these things get in the way of competing.
Anton Troyanovsky is in Rio for the Wall Street Journal. Anton, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Jeb.
It's a big day for dressage at the Olympics, you know, the well-dressed people on those dancing horses. And if you don't do it yourself or you're not into it, dressage seems a little weird. But it has an ancient and surprising history, at least according to the world's very own history guy, Chris Wolfe. So, Chris, I know you're going to surprise me, but what is dressage and where does it come from?
Well, I think the most modern equivalent would be to imagine if driving a tank was suddenly offered up as an Olympic sport, because that's kind of what it is. It's how to control a weapon of war. And through most of history, man and a horse together have been a weapon of war, like the modern tank, you know, where the speed, power, and maneuverability is far superior to the common foot soldier. So in terms of what's really going on in dressage, it's the rider showing off, in the ancient military art, of how well they could control the horse, or really, you know, as they would say, the man and the horse working together in harmony.
It's so interesting. I mean, I knew it was ritualistic, and I would have said akin to dancing. I did not know it was military.
Yeah, so the idea is that they're responding primarily to the rider's weight and legs rather than to, like, whip and spur, which is kind of the old brutal kind of horse riding. And then in battle, what you need is to move your horse quickly from side to side, to go from a complete stop off to a gallop very quickly, or to change direction quickly. You know, these are vital survival skills on the battlefield. And the dancing in place thing, where the front hooves are kind of pawing the ground, that's actually designed to stomp a fallen enemy.
Wow. So how far back does it go?
Well, almost back as far as horse riding itself or the equestrian arts. People have been competing to show off how well they can control their horses. And the first documented guide on how to look after your horse, I'm sure it's been going on through all cultures and all times that people have had their best practices. But the ancient Greeks were, of course, the first to write it down. There was a guy called Xenophon, very famous warrior, also a great writer. And really, his principles on what's called classical dressage kind of form the foundation of the modern sport.
So it goes way back, but does that mean it was actually in the ancient Olympics?
Not as far as we know. They had like horse riding and chariot racing, but not dressage in terms of just pure control.
So when does modern dressage appear? When do competitions begin?
It really depends how Eurocentric you like your history. In Europe, the kind of fancy equitational skills that we think about, you know, with modern dressage kind of fell away with the fall of the Roman Empire and didn't come back till the Renaissance. You think of medieval knights being, well, didn't they have the good horsemanship? Not really. It was kind of like point the horse at the other guy and try and knock him off, and that was about it. But obviously in China, in the Middle East, and even in West Africa, North Africa, the styles and skills of equitation continued with the very delicate control of the horse. In Europe, though, it's back in the Renaissance, and then it's from that that we get our modern kind of European-presented dressage that you see in the Olympics today.
So how long has it been part of the Olympics?
So first appeared in the 1912 Stockholm Olympics, so pretty early on in Olympic history, but pretty much exclusively, well, it was exclusively men at the beginning, and predominantly cavalry men, you know, showing off the how well they could control their horses in the ancient way. And it kind of got showier every 4 years, started off as kind of a little obedience test and then got more fancy. But then, of course, World War II, tanks, aeroplanes, cavalry is no longer important. U.S. cavalry gives up its last combat unit of horses in the 1940s. And pretty much at the same time, you suddenly find that women are coming to dominate the sport around the world. And then finally, women are admitted to the Olympics in 1952. And it seems only fair, since the first recorded cavalry culture in the world, the Scythians of what's now modern Ukraine, this is about the time of the ancient Greeks or before the ancient Greeks, had as many female warriors as male. So it seems only fair that now that they're back in the saddle.
Chris, are you a rider?
I wish. It's on the bucket list, but I've ridden camels, I've ridden donkeys, I've ridden elephants, but not horses. Not yet.
How is it possible you've ridden all those creatures and not a horse?
I was actually always kind of deterred by all the stable work and grooming that you'd have to go along with riding a horse. I'm kind of inherently lazy, I think, at least when
slacker.
It comes to manual
slacker,
labor.
Slacker, or you were too busy reading your history books.
That's it.
The world's one-man history desk, Chris Wolfe, thank you.
You're welcome, Jeb.
And you're listening to The World. Right now, there are about 50,000 refugees stuck in Greece. They can't go on to Northern Europe, where they'd like to apply for asylum, and they can't go back to their homes in places like Syria and Iraq. That's the case for about 3,500 Yazidis. They're part of a religious minority in Iraq, and their community has suffered greatly there at the hands of ISIS extremists. Now, the Yazidis who've made it to Greece are staying in refugee camps. But instead of finding safety there, many have faced more abuse from other migrants who consider them infidels. Reporter Jean Carstensen visited the only camp in Greece that's exclusively for Yazidis. She recently made the long drive to Camp Petra from Athens.
I stopped to pick up Salim Noah. He's a Yazidi refugee who lives at a camp outside of Athens. Salim volunteered at Petra in March when the camp opened as a safe haven for Yazidis. Now he's offered to make the journey to Petra to show me around. At a rest stop, Salim gets a message from a volunteer at Petra. More than 100 Yazidis arrived just the night before. Police evacuated them from another camp. Salim explains.
She's saying that now we have 130 from Cherso, because they get a bad treatment with Muslim and they were attacking them.
When we arrive at Petra, kids are running around a field with white military tents. At first glance, it looks like a summer camp, but it's home to a lot of trauma. Inside a camp office, we meet Emma Azidi. She's a Yazidi who lives in Germany, but she's been volunteering here for many months. She explains that Petra was set up in March when Yazidis were being harassed by Muslim refugees in the Edomeni camp on the Greek-Macedonia border. Salim translates.
They were attacking them, fighting them with knives.
Petra was initially set up to shelter 800 Yazidis, but it swelled to almost double that size.
Daily we get phone calls from the other camps that we have Yazidis there, and they are calling us, telling, please save us.
An elder, Sheikh Nouri, reminds us that the Yazidis at Petra have already been displaced for 2 years. They had to flee their home in 2014 when ISIS attacked Sinjar in northern Iraq.
They killed our kids. They raped our girls.
But in the camps scattered around Greece, many Yazidis still don't feel secure. Sheikh Nouri says the violence at Herso shows that hatred also haunts them here.
This shows you that still attacking Yazidis, still we are not safe in Greece.
The conditions at Petra are extremely poor. But compared to what they've experienced in other camps, Emma says it's still a refuge of sorts. At least the kids can play here.
Yeah, they are playing, they are happy there because they feel safe.
Salim takes me for a walk around the camp. It's 8 p.m. and humming with activity. I spot a woman cooking something in a pot over the campfire.
Ooh, what is she cooking there?
We call like kutilk. Yeah, it's bread and inside like tomatoes, meat and anything, potatoes, anything you can put inside, yeah.
Salim runs into an 11-year-old girl he knows named Ezdihar.
Do they have problems with animals here getting in the tents?
Her family, they killed 4 scorpions before a few days.
Inside the tent?
2 inside, 2 outside the tent.
Salim says he met Ezdihar when he was working here, and they've stayed in touch.
Yeah, we are in touch by WhatsApp. She's smart, English, some German.
Quite a bit of English, yes.
Yeah.
Are there any German classes here?
He's saying no German class, but she, because she wants to learn, she's asking those volunteers from Germany to teach her.
Later, we meet some girls who arrived the night before with the group from Herso camp. They tell us that when volunteers tried to give them food, Arab refugees would harass them.
When some volunteers or some NGO tried to give us something, they were taking it from us.
But for now at least, the girls feel free.
Now we can't breathe. When we get out from the camp, now we can't breathe.
But there's still a lot of anxiety. The Yazidis have waited months to register with the asylum service in Greece, and they'll have to wait even longer for the chance to reunite with family in Germany. That's where Ezdahar and everyone else here at Petra hopes to go.
Can you count in German?
For the world, Jean Carstensen, Petra Camp, Greece.
Jean's reporting is supported by a grant from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Let's stay in Greece. Documentary filmmaker Chris Kosouras has visited a lot of refugee camps there. He's part of a group of filmmakers working with a foundation called What Took You So Long? And their goal is to show a different side of the refugee crisis, the positive moments.
Yeah, there are a lot of sad moments, there are a lot of sad people, but those sad people smile.
Kosouras says each time they visited a camp, he and his team would do a couple of things that helped them connect with the refugees. First, they stayed in the camp with the refugees. And second, they helped people directly, even if it meant giving up on the perfect shot for the documentary.
Me and a colleague of mine, we were living at the camp filming. The situation got much worse in the camp. The army started cutting off food supplies because they're trying to get people out of the camp that we were in. And instead of filming, we decided to delay the project for a few weeks, and we stayed and we worked and we just lived with them. To a certain extent, we do believe that if you're filming three people struggling to lift a large box of food to feed a bunch of other people, your job in that situation, if they can't lift the box, is to help them lift the box, not film them failing to lift the box.
Kosouras says there were many instances when everyone around pitched in to help, like that time when he was filming in Athens and the Greek army stopped delivering lunches to 1,500 people.
It was a very horrible situation followed by a very beautiful one. And the independent volunteers sat down. Everyone had their own mini nervous breakdown because no one knew what to do. And then everyone kind of just looked at each other and said, okay, well, we're certainly not going to do nothing. So we're going to have to figure this out. And they figured it out. And then they created a program to cook lunch for 1,500 people. They founded an organization to build a kitchen in a warehouse. And the next day, they cooked for 1,500 people successfully, not without disasters and problems and whatnot. But the next day had maybe 15 nationalities in a warehouse cooking, refugees, volunteers, didn't matter. And everyone just came together, listened to some music, and had an absolute blast. And creating those kinds of moments, doesn't matter if you're in a refugee camp or if you're at a friend's house and you see everyone get up and clean up all together. Those are beautiful human moments to experience.
Filmmaker Chris Kosouras is working on a documentary about the refugee camps in Greece. You can find photos from his trip over at PRI.org. You're listening to The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. Millions of dollars worth of Indian rupees were packed in crates on a moving train. But when it arrived,
they opened up the carriage, which had been carefully sealed, guarded by police, and found that some of the crates were already open. And there was a large hole in the roof, and nobody quite understands what happened.
The Great Train Robbery, Tamil Nadu style, coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Jeb Sharp, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Guns are at the forefront of the U.S. political debate today, thanks to Donald Trump. The Republican presidential nominee yesterday suggested that, quote, Second Amendment people could somehow stop his Democratic rival Hillary Clinton. The Clinton campaign condemned the comment as dangerous. Well, we're going to hear now about another country where guns are at the forefront of the national political debate. I'm talking about the Philippines. Voters there elected a new president in May. His name is Rodrigo Duterte. And during the campaign, Duterte offered a simple formula for dealing with criminals and drug addicts. Kill them all, he said. Some in the media dubbed him Duterte Harry. Now that he's in office, hundreds of people have been turning up dead. Tom Smith follows Southeast Asia closely and lectured at De La Salle University, Manila.
Duterte, throughout his campaign, let's say, enjoyed the microphone and made some fairly outrageous statements, was very popular for doing so. He's coming off the back of one-term president, Ninoy Aquino, who was painted as a very establishment, very boring character who'd not really brought any reforms to the masses of the Philippines. And Duterte is very much seen as the antidote to that. Duterte is promising wild reforms, particularly to do with crime, with the drug problem that the Philippines has, and has waged an all-out war on drugs in his first month or so in office. And this is causing carnage, really, on the streets of Manila and elsewhere throughout the country. And it looks like people are now taking this beyond mere drug criminality to more wider criminality, to take Duterte his word that that all criminals are, in a sense, fair game.
And when you say it's causing carnage, who's actually doing the killing? Is it police? Is it vigilantes? Is it people being ordered to do so?
Frankly, we don't know. What we do know is there has been around 400 to 500 of those deaths admitted by the police. So that's kind of self-defense deaths caused by the police in the process of arresting who they say are drug pushers, drug users. And those are kind of being more or less acquiesced by Duterte's government. He's saying, you know, carry on, lads, that's fine, keep going. Then there's around, again, figures are very hard to verify, but the figure around 700 deaths is being reported directly as a result of the war on drugs. So that leaves at least another 300 to 400 people who have also been killed and are usually left with a cardboard sign by their body, which accuses them of being a drug pusher or a drug user. Now, who's killing these people? Nobody knows. When he was mayor of Davao City in Mindanao prior to becoming president, Duterte was certainly accused very strongly, and he didn't deny this, of using death squads to clean up Davao City, which, to his credit, you know, he certainly did do that, and crime levels did fall under his watch. He's, you know, was not shy about admitting using very rough tactics to do that. And it looks like this has now been played out at a national level.
So would you surmise that these killings, even if they're not directly tied to Duterte, are what he intended all along?
He's doing nothing to quell them. His supporters, who are very public, are saying that this is his success. This is down to him. This is, you know, a success of his first month in office, that there's more to come.
And is it generally understood that Duterte was elected because of the kind of rhetoric he was using during the campaign about killing drug dealers, etc.?
Yes, Duterte promised to end all crime, not just drug crime. He promised to end all crime within a year of his administration. He promised all sorts of crazy things. And people were very, very keen to see his success from Davao City at a national level.
How do you explain Duterte's popularity in the Philippines? This is a man who challenged a rival to a gun duel and seemed to gloat about personally shooting three men accused of kidnapping a girl. Why is he so popular?
He painted himself as a very different character to Ninoy Aquino, who people were bored of. And Duterte's kind of stepped into that void as somebody happy to give quotes, happy to speak to ordinary, uneducated, working-class masses throughout the Philippines, and is an anti-Manila candidate. The Philippines is 7,000 islands. This is an incredibly complex political geography to navigate, and Duterte's painted himself as a blank canvas to do something different. What exactly that something different is of course, a different question.
Tom Smith follows Southeast Asia closely and lectured at De La Salle University, Manila. Tom, thanks so much.
No problem.
If you've visited the coast of Northern Europe recently, you've probably noticed something offshore besides boats and seabirds, the huge white towers and blades of wind turbines. European countries began building offshore wind farms a generation ago, but as of right now, here in the U.S., there are exactly zero offshore wind farms. Not for long, though. Just last week, America's first offshore wind turbine was completed off the coast of Rhode Island. It's part of a 5-turbine project that could be finished this month. But even if that wind farm will be American, the technology and know-how behind it are definitely European. From our environment desk, here's the world's Carolyn Beeler.
Hello again.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Block Island is about 13 miles off the coast of Rhode Island. It's known for the quaint Main Street you see when you step off the ferry, and for the long sandy beaches and nature preserves that are just a short bike ride away. The island's past is rooted in this identity as a favorite New England vacation spot. But its future lies about 3 miles off of its southern coast.
You can definitely see them clearly from this part of the island.
That's Kim Gaffett. She's standing on a bluff, pointing to five huge metal platforms on the horizon.
What you see is basically the platforms that the wind turbines are going to be built up on. And those platforms are actually anchored into the ocean floor.
These turbines will be the first in U.S. waters. An earlier project off of Cape Cod would have been the first, but was derailed by opposition from residents. That didn't happen here. Gaffett was head of the town council when the wind farm was proposed, and she says that's partly because Block Islanders are pretty eco-friendly.
The people who live and work here feel strongly that we need to do things for our environment, so there's a real philosophical belief in this.
This being clean, carbon-free energy. There's also a more immediate reason. Block Island currently gets its electricity by burning diesel shipped over from the mainland. That means it's pricey. In much of the rest of the country, offshore wind would cost way more than most other sources. But here, it might actually be cheaper.
There was a real advantage to trying to find an alternative way to produce power that was less expensive.
The project developer says by the end of the year, the five turbines will generate enough electricity for 17,000 homes. The turbine's construction is being overseen from the Port of Providence, about 50 miles away.
Nice to see you again, Chris. How are you doing?
That's Chris Van Beek, the president of Deepwater Wind. That's the company that's developing this wind farm. His Dutch accent and his colleague's French one are just a few I overheard as he walked me around the port.
If you add up all nationalities working on this project, probably you come to 20, 25 nationalities.
The U.S. is new to the offshore wind game, and the huge offshore turbine parts aren't built here. So Deepwater Wind bought them from Europe. On the port's loading dock, Van Beek shows me tower sections and 250-foot-long blades waiting to be shipped out to Block Island.
The towers were fabricated in Spain. The blades were fabricated in Denmark. The Danes are very good and specialized in that kind of work.
The U.S. has been slow to adopt offshore wind, partly because it has lots of wide-open land that's good for cheaper onshore wind. It has domestic natural gas and coal and low electricity prices. And it has bureaucracy. Deepwater Wind had to get approval from roughly a dozen agencies for this wind farm.
Yeah, it's harder here. There's no template for it. So what we do is a lot of meetings with the regulator, sitting there and saying, well, this is how we want to do that.
The regulations are starting to get ironed out as East Coast states work with developers to meet ambitious new renewable energy goals. They want to tap into winds that blow hard and consistently off the coast. Still, the public hasn't totally been won over, even on Block Island. 16-year-old Tatum Shaw says the wind farm ruins the view from a bluff near her family's summer house.
It used to be beautiful, and now basically you face a certain way, and it's ugly, and you see them, and they look super up close. And then when you face the other way, it's natural and beautiful like it's supposed to be.
But back up on that bluff with a bunch of tourists, former town council head Kim Gaffett was tickled to point out that not everyone agrees with Shaw.
People have been, since last summer, coming up here to see this. As much as there are people who don't want to see them, there are people coming here to see them.
Gaffett hopes this interest paves the way for bigger offshore wind projects that are in the pipeline, and that one day the U.S. coastline will look a bit more like Europe's. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Block Island, Rhode Island.
Back now to the Olympic Games in Rio. But don't worry, no scores or medal counts here in case you're holding out for NBC's primetime TV coverage. Instead, we're going to check in with one of the many journalists covering the Games who also happens to be a local. My BBC colleague, Julia Carneiro, is a Rio native, a Carioca. What's it like having the Olympics in your hometown?
It's quite remarkable, Jed, because it's quite a thrill to see all the sports events suddenly happening in your city, in the streets that you're accustomed to by your neighborhood. The road cycling went right by my house. The rowing competitions are happening on the lagoon where I myself have rowed when I was in my university years. So it's quite a thrill to see that landscape suddenly taken over by this world event, and also all the athletes from around the world coming here, all the visitors coming here, and especially after the build-up to the Olympics, that was, well, I guess we had some months of quite negative news and skepticism about the Games. Well, it's happening, it's here, and it's going quite well. It's quite amazing.
That sounds really wonderful. What's sort of particular to Rio that wouldn't be happening at any other Olympics? Can you kind of feel the Rio-ness?
I think so. I think Rio really is a very friendly city that likes to welcome people from abroad. So you have this festive atmosphere, especially in places that where you have, for instance, the live site at the harbor area of Rio, where there are screens set up, where the competitions are being seen. That's working quite well. Lots of people going there to follow the competitions. There are food trucks set up for people to have snacks. Yeah, it is quite festive. You have the downside as well. I think we have to remember that Brazil is a developing country and not everything here is super efficient. So you have people complaining about transportation can take very long. It takes very long to get here to the Olympic Park. Also here in the venues in the Olympic Park, for instance, there were several problems in the first day, especially with very long queues to get in to go through the security scans. But you have the positive side as well, which is how welcoming cariocas are.
What single event has generated the most buzz there for cariocas for Brazilians in Rio?
I think the road cycling was quite remarkable to see because it really crossed the city. It went up and down steep and curvy hills here. It crossed the hills of the Tijuca Forest, which is a big urban forest here in Rio. And we also had some nasty accidents there over the weekend with a very challenging race course. But I think it really was a course that helped people understand and visualize what Rio is and how big the city is and really gave a glimpse into the quite fascinating landscape that we have here by the sea, with the mountains, with all the beaches. I think the cyclers that were, of course, they were very concentrated on their race, but they could see a little bit of all of that. They really had it all. So the world that was watching that really got a very interesting glimpse into Rio and all the geography of the city.
I would say you're absolutely right. I watched those races and there was so much drama. I imagine it was amazing when Brazil won its first gold, the gold for judo, Rafaela Silva.
Yes, it was remarkable. People here really celebrated it. Rafaela Silva is a judoka from a very poor community here in Rio. She was born in the City of God, which is a favela that's very close to the Olympic Park, but portrays these contrasts of Rio very well, the rich neighborhoods close to the very poor neighborhoods. And she, well, she has this very humble background and is really a fighter. And she had hopes of getting a medal in London in 2012, but she was disqualified in the early stages. And after that, she suffered a wave of racist attacks on the internet, which really, according to her, really made her almost give up. I spoke to her yesterday and she took the gold medal from out of her pocket and was very proud showing it around. She says she doesn't know yet where she'll keep it. But I was at her parents' house. They still live in a very simple house right next to the favela. It's really a story of how a victory like this can inspire other children, the children from the training center where she grew up as a judoka. They were all thrilled to see her gold and saying that, well, it really comes to prove that if she could do it, they could do it as well. And if it's not a gold that they're aiming for, it's being someone big in life.
My BBC colleague, Julia Carneiro in Rio. So great to speak with you, Julia.
Thank you, Jeb.
I'm Jeb Sharp with The World. Quick question. What are your pronouns? I use she, her, hers.
Well, I use they, them, and theirs, and that's what this podcast is about this week.
That's Paulus Van Horn, one of our interns here in the newsroom this summer, and the latest contributor to The World in Words, our podcast about language.
Anything I, you, we, and they are all ungendered, so he and she are really the only pronouns that reference gender at all. They, them, theirs is an attempt to be more inclusive of gender nonconforming and non-binary people, or just when you don't know the gender of the person you're talking about.
And you use they, them, their. How long has they been used as a gender-neutral pronoun?
I think the earliest reference that we've found is about the 1500s, going back basically to the time of Shakespeare, according to the linguist Dennis Barron, who I talked to for this episode.
The TH pronouns were borrowed by Old English from Scandinavian.
Scandinavian. They is originally Scandinavian?
Yeah, and actually our language, English, is really a hodgepodge of many different influences. So all of the hand-wringing that I typically get when introducing myself with they, them, theirs, that this is not grammatically correct, really that piece of information reminds me that English is malleable and it is subject to change all of the time.
There have been attempts, though, to create other gender-neutral pronouns, right?
Absolutely. In the 1960s, you see quite a few synthetic pronouns, I would say, that try to deal with some of these issues.
Your linguist, Dennis Barron, actually compiled a list. Any good ones on that list?
I really like thar, because it's sort of pirate sounding.
Thar.
T-H-A-R, and also thon, T-H-O-N, which is actually in the dictionary, although no one really uses it. I guess if you want to get a few points in Scrabble, that might be a good one.
What about other languages? Have there been other attempts to create a more gender-neutral language?
Very recently in Sweden in the early 2000s, you see the proliferation of this word hen, which is pretty close to he or she in the language, but has actually found mainstream success. It actually originates in the 1960s. And has kind of resurfaced as gender issues have become more forefront in the country.
Do you have the feeling that we're going to hear a lot more suggestions, experiments?
I think they has started to kind of solidify as the go-to pronoun. Last year, even the American Dialectical Society named they as the singular pronoun the word of the year. So I think we're sort of on a trajectory. That being said, every year there seems to be a new pronoun, someone else coming up with a better way. They just don't seem to stick.
Paulus, can I ask you why you use they, them, their?
The short answer is that I'm neither a man nor a woman, but for a longer answer, you'll just have to listen to the podcast this week.
Nice. You can subscribe to The World in Words on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much, Paulus.
Yeah, thank you.
Paulus Van Horn, one of our amazing interns this summer here at The World. Finally today, a train job that seems straight out of Hollywood, except that it really did take place in India. And it features well-worn banknotes, an express train, and blowtorch-wielding thieves. I asked my colleague Jill McGivering to tell us more. She's South Asia editor for the BBC.
We're basically looking at a vast number of banknotes. These are ones that were being taken out of circulation because they were very used, they were crumpled, they were soiled, they were damaged. And they'd been brought together from various banks and all gathered together into more than 200 crates, which were loaded into a series of carriages on an express train. It was supposed to be very heavily guarded and they were making a journey across the southern Indian state of Tamil Nadu to the capital of that state, Chennai, where they were going to be destroyed and then replacements would be sent out by the Reserve Bank of India. But when the train completed its long overnight, nearly 200-mile journey, they opened up the carriage, which had been carefully sealed, guarded by police, and found that some of the crates were already open. A lot of the money had gone, nearly $750,000 equivalent in Indian rupees, and there was a large hole in the roof of that particular carriage, which was metal. It had been cut out by steel welding equipment, and nobody quite understands what happened.
Do we even know if the train was moving when they broke into it? Would it have to have been?
That is a really good question, and that's one of the things they're trying to figure out. There have been cases in the past in India where robbers have got onto the tops of moving trains and managed to steal things from passengers or from cargo underneath. So that it's possible. There's one stretch of line which is not electrified. So one theory is that perhaps on that particular stretch, if this was very well planned, the robbers had got onto the roof there and made a big hole in the roof and got inside that way. Another possibility is that they got inside the carriage before it was sealed, right at the start of the journey, and then were basically inside, waited their opportunity, and then took the money, then made the hole in order to escape. But it sounds so far, either the police are being very tight-lipped, or frankly, they just don't quite yet know. We know that they're interviewing all sorts of people involved in the process, from bank employees to railway staff and porters. They've also been going up and down stretches of railway line, trying to see if there's evidence of any notes that have been left to try and give them an idea about where on this long track this might have happened. And they're looking at CCTV footage as well. But certainly it sounds as though they're not quite sure.
Has this ever happened before? Is there a precedent for this kind of heist?
Not really in India on this scale. There are immediately comparisons being made. I guess you'd expect it, wouldn't you, to the Great Train Robbery, as it was called in the UK in 1963, partly just because it seemed also very audacious and because similarly, that, of course, that was on a train, on a mail train in that case. But it's been interesting watching the Indian media, which has been having a bit of fun with this. I think there's something of a romance around these sorts of big train robberies. So there are all sorts of comparisons being made, both with, as I say, the UK, but also with various legendary train robberies in the Wild West.
It's just so made for movies. It's so filmic. I can see it, even though I don't know the details.
It's a Bollywood plot right there, isn't it? Add a few songs and dances, and I think they've got a made for Bollywood film. I think that will come.
Jill, you talked about the money that it seems to be missing, approximately $750,000, but the coach was carrying 3.4 billion rupees, which is the equivalent of $51 million.
Yes, and a lot of this was in quite small denomination notes. And some, it looks as though they only opened two of the crates, I gather, and there were more than 200 altogether. So clearly only a fraction of the money has gone. Some of the smaller denomination notes were left scattered, so clearly they had a little bit of time to sort through and be effective in what they took. But even so, the amount of money that they removed was apparently more than 20 tons in weight. So, you know, you're looking at there are a lot of rupees to the dollar. So you're looking at a lot of small value notes they were having to get out. And just physically, that might have been quite a feat. They clearly just couldn't take it all.
Well, thank you for telling us the story. The BBC's South Asia editor, Jill McGivering.
My pleasure.
And that's our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Jeb Sharp. We're back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.